Welcome to the Strong Source Commodity Podcast. We are your hosts, Martijn Bron and Alexander Sterk.
Welcome to another episode of the Strong Source Podcast. Today we have a very special guest because he has the same name as my co-host, Martijn. So it makes it very easy for me today. Martijn Noordhoek, head of marketing and global supply chain at Viterra. But actually, let's call him Mr. Sugar, because he's been his whole life from Cargill to Sugden, Glencore, and now Viterra in the world of sugar. And we met now a few years back. I got to know you, and we started with Vesper in the world of sugar. And then basically, you were the one that dragged me along into all these sugar events. And then you invited me to the sugar dinner in London, where I could get my penguin suit again. You helped me along the way and into the world of sugar, and I'm very grateful for that. But it also, in this time, I also learned the experience that you have in sugar, how many people in the world of sugar, everybody likes you. So that's a good thing, I think, to know. Maybe your wife thinks differently, but at least these people do. Also, due to you, I got to know Chris Mahoney. You've been in this podcast as well, who I got to know very well. So I'm super excited that you're here.
Thank you.
And we can discuss with you this beautiful world of sugar.
Sure, absolutely.
Fantastic. So welcome to this podcast, Martijn.
Thank you very much. Nice to be here.
So I think for us, tell us a bit about yourself, how you ended up in this world of sugar, because everybody always coincidentally ended up in the world of commodities. How did your story start?
Yeah. It's a bit like this as well. Yes, indeed. So my name is Martijn Noordhoek. I'm married. I have two kids, two lovely daughters. We live very near here in Bloemendaal. And I grew up actually in Lisse. Lisse is a village quite near here as well. Tulip area. Agricultural area as well. The first, first time to encounter agricultural work in this village. And after finishing high school, I went studying in Rotterdam at the Erasmus University. After graduation, I applied for a job at Cargill, commercial traineeship. And I started not in sugar actually in Cargill. I started in freight, so it was a chartering of small boats. That's where I met Martijn as well. We worked together in the same office. And so first of all, chartering for about 1.5 years, something like this. And then in Amsterdam, I got a bit poached by a small sugar trading desk that started up in Amsterdam. And this is where it started for sugar.
But then before you, if applying for a job at Cargill, I mean, you expect that somebody would apply for Nestle or Unilever, these famous companies that we all know. But you know, Cargill is not. Was that so famous when you?
No, it wasn't. No, certainly not.
Even though it's maybe bigger than all these other companies, but it's still. Was it just by coincidence that you heard of it, or was it a?
No, it was certainly not a coincidence. There were a few people that I knew as well from the fraternities and stuff and university. Like a guy like Dan Vriends.
Yeah, I was in the podcast as well.
Yeah, he was. Yeah. So certainly it was a small world, but in Rotterdam, pretty famous actually. Yeah. And the interview process back then was really short. Everything done in one day. You know, you had like four interviews and then you knew yes or no within a day. So
And nowadays, Cargill interviews are days, weeks.
Longer. Certainly. Yeah, I'm sure.
And in the world of sugar, I mean, you've been at different sugar desks.
Yeah.
What is so nice about this world of sugar that you are so stuck to it?
Yeah, it's really a nice commodity to trade. It's pretty diversified. I started off with white sugar. So white sugar is traded in bags. It's fit for human consumption. It trades very much like a soft commodity. And then later on, while you get more experience, you like to take bigger positions and have more exposure. And then you almost automatically go more into the raw sugar trading, which then compares itself much better to corn or grains, how it's traded. So it's pretty diversified. And then at a certain stage, you get to know so many people, as you say, in this business. And then you stick around. Between Cargill, how we traded sugar, and then Sugden in France, how we traded or approached the market. And now Viterra, it's been really very, very different. So it kept me going. It's been diversified enough to stay engaged. Let's put it this way. Yeah, certainly. Nice. Yeah.
Hey, Martijn. Yeah. So there's lots of young people attending, listening to this podcast. And they always ask, how do you break into the commodities industry? And I think that they also do not really have a good impression of what the early years are like. So when you come from university, I mean, the transition from university to actually becoming a professional is quite big. And especially in the commodity trading business, because in most universities, you learn very little about it. Mm-hmm. Now, can you share a bit how you, from university, you said freight, but we can focus on sugar, how you actually managed to not be overwhelmed and actually bring structure to your day and create an environment where you actually thought, I can now more or less connect the dots and I understand what the numbers on the screen means. And you may recall in the beginning being part of a merchandising meeting, mm-hmm. getting used to the vocabulary. Could you share a bit on how you experienced that early days and how long it took you to really feel like, I can understand what the seniors on the desk say, and actually I'm ready to put the position on and actually understand where I need to look at all those things.
Wow, it's an extensive question and requires an extensive answer. But still, Martijn, I'd like to go back to this chartering and freight and the reason for it is that I you know, when you start, so certainly at first it was like considered to be an easier market. Let's put it this way: the freight market, relatively mm-hmm. Easy to understand. The good thing I thought is that you get exposure to all the different trading desks. So in our case, it was indeed the grains desk, the sugar desks, but as well, you yourself were part of a crushing facility. So all the guys that were involved there, they required freight as well. And I got to understand a little bit better, at least from their perspective, how this world worked. And then thereafter, when you start to work in a commodity trade environment that has more exposure to futures and physical trading. Yeah, it's at first it's overwhelming. It certainly is, and it's quite difficult to grasp what's happening ahead of you. And then, before you put on your first position, or before you actually understand all the relative values of all the mm-hmm. origins, all the different products that are there. Yeah, in my case, I think it took me at least like three years to fully grasp what's going on there. And to be ready, indeed, as you say, to put on a position, or to feel for yourself, like, okay, if people ask me, I could partly run a part of this book, but it takes a long time. Yeah, it really does.
I was hoping that you would say something like this, because what I notice among the youngsters is that they are impatient.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I say to them, look, formally the traineeship that we started, that took about 2 years.
Yeah.
No. But I also said, like, the first time that I really felt like I could connect the dots, and my first major game plan that I sent out, and you recall how it went in Cargill at the
Absolutely,
time,
yes.
You had to send out to a lot of people on copy with some big egos. And then the email thread started, right, with people supporting or challenging you. Now, but that was the first time I did that was after nearly like 3 years.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah. And I also recall earlier than that I was sitting in the car with Erik Swartberg.
Now at Upfield.
What? Huh?
Now at Upfield.
Yeah, exactly. A fantastic guy, tough guy as well. But I said to him that I didn't understand anything of the merchandising meetings. And I just wanted to get it out of my system. Fortunately, he reacted to that very, very positively. He said, look, Martijn, it takes time.
Yeah.
It is
complicated.
But what
do you guys do then the first 3 years? So when you come in, what is the first 3 years that you do? Is just executing the trades that a lot of people want and reading in what the challenges are?
There's lots of stuff. There's lots of stuff that you need to understand, the vocabulary, but especially also what Martijn says, the relative value of things. Yeah, and across sports in Europe, and in my case, Rapeseed Oil versus Sun Oil, and going through your S&Ds. But Martijn, you're the guest, so you answer this question.
No, it's like this, and there's certainly like the first few years. Yeah, okay. So
I was just getting coffee for the older ones.
No, part of it. Yeah. Part of but it. No. It's certainly there was execution that you had to follow for yourself. I mean, the first 6 months you were just doing execution jobs and understanding the trade and reading contracts and you know. Charter parties or vessels. If you trade commodities and you don't understand the charter parties, you just go. So this is stuff that, okay, you. It takes time. It takes time to understand. But this is like the first few months, and thereafter, you slowly actually develop yourself to like first trades, and that you understand what you're trading, what values do you give out, and the guys, without an exception, were nervous from the first time that a broker or a counterpart would say yes, okay, yeah, you're booked.
Oh, yeah.
And it was a special moment in Cargill, and it still is.
What did you do?
How
did you celebrate then?
You have like first trade rings, absolutely. And the same happens today in Viterra.
And is there a rule that a first trade can never be before 6 months or whatever, a few months? Is there like this rule that within Cargill
the
that
rule
you
is that if you, it could be earlier, but then you had no clue what you sold or bought.
That's also nice.
Yeah. No, I know stories as well that brokers would call up after the trade was done saying, okay, can you unwind it? Because your manager is going to be really angry with me for having you booked this. So it's you need to understand what you're doing, how relative values work.
I can recall that when I booked on trades, and then my manager Edwin, he said, and did you actually ask for the packaging? Did you actually ask where did you have to X-Works pick it up? I was like, oh God! So then I had to call back to finalize my trade actually on the phone. I was like, oh God! And that just didn't happen one time, but multiple times. I was like, it's good that you have that first trade moment and you got the execution.
Absolutely.
But it takes a month. But then let's say if you are in year one, going to year two.
Well, the whole thing with the job of trading is it is a pretty complicated. It's not rocket science, the whole market, but it is complicated. But it's a puzzle.
And do you do it differently at Viterra than now, for example? Do you still use the same what you've learned, how you do it, or?
Yeah, well, I mean, the business we run in Viterra, the sugar business, is really different from how we were running it in Cargill and in Sukden.
Yeah.
And the main difference is that we have factories in Brazil.
Yeah.
We run these factories at the best of our knowledge and possibility. But we are partly even farmers. I mean to say, we have 100,000 hectares of land, of cane land. We need to crush it. It needs to go to the factory. Then the stuff that comes out, we need to elevate ourselves. We buy inland in Brazil. And that all falls under inland in Brazil sugar. That all falls under the umbrella of Rotterdam and in Cargill. Yeah, it's much more trading model where we were trading it generally
around FOB, the assets, not with the assets.
Generally FOB CNF type of trade and then of course a large proprietary book. But it requires really a different mindset what we do today.
If you have a few guys in your team, do they then have a different setup of how you of when you get them in your team? Is that do you train them different? Is it a different way of starting? Do you say, well, you go first to the fields and to the factories, etc., and I see you in a few months back when you've learned it? Is that different? Do you, the manager and the big boss yourself, is then you change that versus how you've been taught the world of trading?
But in broad perspective, it still requires kind of the same mindset. I think from the new hires, there might be different profiles from the people that we hired back then. Maybe we kind of ask for a little bit of different personalities, maybe a bit more open-minded to AI or technology in general than what we were taught. We were taught to be just hyper commercial, number driven. And today, maybe it requires as well a bit more an open mindset to more technology. But at the same time, you still need to come with energy to your job, and you need to be focused and happy and enjoy to solve the puzzle of a commodity. Because in general, it's like solving problems, trying to look at the S&D, come up with game plans. What Martijn said, it still kind of requires the same people. Yeah, so yes and no.
Yep.
Yeah, before I go to my question, because we talked about our early start I thought about one joke that was taking place often with trainees on the desk. And they did it with me as well. So they said, look, and you execute basically what the seniors say, yeah, without thinking much. And they said, look, but you need to buy $1 now. What is that $1? So you call the FX desk. You say, well, without knowing really what it means, I need to buy $1. Okay, done. And then the confirmation came in. And turned out it was $1 million. And then the senior came to me and said, what have you done? I said, yeah, well, I bought $1. No, you bought $1 million, right? And you start to panic. And that's all the kind of the games that they do on the desk to make you think. Yeah? Yeah. That is what is interesting, that along the way, you start to challenge everything people tell you, also from external parties. So you are... you are taught to challenge everything and think for yourself and don't take anything for granted. And it starts with these kind of silly, small things. And coming back to Alexander's question, a lot has to do with very quickly adapting to a world that you don't know, and a very professional, competitive world where a lot of money is made or lost and everyone wants your dollar. Right.
Yeah.
Now, that as a side note, one thing on the sugar and something that, and I was already in Geneva and I didn't know much about the sugar market. And then I saw a presentation from Jonathan Drake, and he said something which was very striking to me. And that's my question to you. He said, "Look, something very different than all the other commodities. There's no crop cycle. So I was used to." Okay, the planting season, and then it's the harvest, and okay, and then you have to wait for the next one. And he said, but that's not the case at all in sugar. It's just like a flowing, yeah, continuous production flow. Can you explain how that works? And if that is the case, how does it impact reading your S&D?
Yeah. So I think mostly what he's talking about is the cane production in Brazil, the largest producer in the world. Certainly the largest exporter. And in Brazil, you have a ratoon cycle of 7 years. And so once you plant...
A ratoon, what is that?
Yeah, so you have a 7 years ratoon. So it means like you plant one stick of cane.
Yeah.
And it will give you 7 years of yield.
Okay.
Yeah, so it grows, you cut. It grows, you cut. And you can do that 7 years if you have good soil. Yeah. And you have a good quality.
And then you need to
cane.
Take it out from the roots,
yes.
And then you replant.
And you need to replant. Yeah.
Okay.
So we look at our S&D as well, like how old is the cane in general? Then we kind of understand as well what the yield supposedly should be in Brazil. So for instance, it varies between average 3 to 4 years. But yeah, if it's 3.2 versus 3.6, it's going to have a different in yield. But this is certainly what he means. And so it trades a little bit more like palm oil, although a palm tree is like 25 years. But in sugar, it's 7 years. But it's really specific for Brazil, because if you, for instance, have cane in China, it's 3 years ratoon. If you have cane in India, it's 2 years ratoon only. And beet, we all know, is only one year, right? Yeah. You need to plant, you get
it
back.
Yeah. Yeah.
So we look at the S&D differently, mean to say that, yeah, if you plant a stick, then yeah, you're going to have cane for 7 years generally. Now, a side effect of this, us like in Viterra being farmers partly, is like, okay, we plant the cane, and then so we know for 7 years we're going to have sugar. And one of the issues how you kind of broadcast your VAR, like how much risk is there in your book actually, is like actually we have like 2 to 3 to 4 to 5 years of sugar in our book. That were long, so to speak.
Yeah.
So how do you
have a natural long? You build with the crop. Yeah.
Mega long, yeah, exactly. And so yeah, this is a part of how we and even trade house to trade house, others that are producers as well have a different approach to how you what your exposure actually is at that point. So that's what he means, right? So it's a long period crop.
Yeah,
it's not like soybeans. It's not like corn. It really trades a bit differently. Yeah.
What was we are now with Vesper, we jump into calls with FMCG companies regarding, now it's about cocoa, With Martijn, we talked about coffee, we talked about dairy, highs, every commodity had its high, and also sugar. Mm-hmm. Sugar was, how long ago were we at 1,000, roughly?
1,000? You mean like dollars in in Europe, 2 years ago.
And you have these extreme highs, and then we go back to 400, whatever, these kind of region.
Yeah.
Is that the only reason is that crop? Is that less product, or is demand changing a lot in sugar? Because I have the feeling that demand in sugar is mainly in different regions than, for example, Europe. If you look at Asia, Africa, they buy still real big bags of sugar, whereas in Europe, if you ask somebody for sugar in the coffee, then it's already a problem.
Yeah.
So is it supply driven? Is it demand driven? Is it, which is, well, because didn't we see that coming, that extreme peak of sugar?
It's certainly, demand is relatively stable. We can certainly discuss here what the effects are going to be on, for instance, something like Ozempic.
Yeah.
What it will do is specifically in the Western world to consumption.
We can basically start eating sugar again because we have Ozempic. And I'd have less hungry.
No, you're not going to eat. No. No, it's an interesting, there's a tremendous amount of stats, but maybe it's for a site. We can certainly discuss it. But I think it's much more a supply driven events. And therefore, maybe it's a bit of a shortcut, but therefore every time that's not like a super cycle. So it's not like that you have like a massive population growth and a massive consumption growth that you really have a super cycle that you go to long-term kind of higher prices. But the ones that you are talking about, these type of peaks, are much more like a supply event.
Yeah.
So we had like in Europe, we had suddenly that they couldn't use any certain types of fertilizer, or they couldn't use against the bees, fumigation, or you cannot protect your crop.
Yeah.
Right. They couldn't do that, and so slowly, pesticides, and they couldn't, and then you slowly saw that either people planted less area and said, okay, this is getting too complicated, or they wanted to, but the yield started dropping because some crop fails. And in Brazil, for instance, you have like you certainly have like swings of production of yield, not so much in area, but for instance in Brazil, 50% of the total crop goes actually to ethanol. So if the ethanol is well priced, if oil prices are quite high, then you see as well that you raise your floor in the sugar prices, and that suddenly you can start to build kind of a lack of sugar supply.
And how can you build that all in your S&D, right? Because you got an energy part then, and not just the food part.
Yeah, you build it in. Sugar is pretty vulnerable to the energy spectrum, specifically in Brazil. Right, in Brazil they mix and blend all they like. It's all flex fuel cars. They can run on 100% ethanol all the way up to zero. So you have to build that in. Yes. So we look at pump parities to see like, okay, where does a liter of ethanol arrive at the pump versus a liter of gasoline?
Yeah.
A car generally can drive like 70% of the distance on a liter of ethanol versus a liter of gasoline. So you need to calculate this. And then there's mandates as well, so how they need to blend it in. So certain things are certainly just stable and fixed.
Yeah.
But the pump parities, can swing our S&D tremendously. Yeah, tremendously.
And you got, for the World of Sugar, you got the ICE in London and New York.
Yes.
How do these two exchanges come into play for Viterra, for your sugar book?
The sugar we produce from our factories is generally just raws. Yeah. So that's raw sugar, that's ICE number 11, and it trades on the New York Exchange. So this is for us is the future that has the most volume.
Yeah, you know, it's with this,
yeah, most liquidity. It's an interesting contract. It's a contract that is deliverable. Mean to say, by the time it expires, you actually,
it's at your doorstep.
It's in a port of choice for the deliverer. Yeah, and generally the average kind of deliverable tonnages, it's anywhere between 400,000 tons up to 2.5 million tons that's being delivered. So it's really an active contract, but active in a way that deliverability is really still a moment of large change in hands of physical volume.
And you trade then also, and then the London ICE, is that the number 5, is that also, It has less liquidity.
Yeah, less liquidity. It's, I think it's about one fifth of the size. So it certainly is less liquid. It's a contract that trades only white sugar. So it's 50 kg bags fit for human consumption.
More pallet trucks.
No, it's a contract that by the time it expires.
Yeah.
Then the change hands is FOB as well. So it needs to go into a breakbulk vessel. You need to present the boat. But it's a choice where you want to have it delivered. So it's in general like 100, 200,000 tons certainly changes hands by the time it expires.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, but these two, between the raws futures and the whites, in between we call the whites premium. So that is the premium that people get from refining the sugar.
Yeah.
So we have all kinds of refineries across the world, and they get a certain premium for refining the sugar.
Yeah, because I learned from you as well, what I found so interesting is that you have refineries, Spain, Italy, some of these regions, and then because the margins are so thin, and like some of the other commodities that you need to be at port, you don't want to drive with these products throughout Europe because then you lose a part of your margin, if I'm correct, right?
Certainly, yeah.
And so,
but these are, for instance, not re-export refineries. These are refineries that import for Europe.
Yeah.
And then they go inland. Spain would deliver to Spain. And yeah. But for instance, you have a refinery in Dubai. Yeah, he refines in order to export, basically. He's got his inland market, certainly, like in Dubai, the UAE. But most of the products is just being shipped out again.
Yeah. And that's all for the alkalis does everything to Africa and these kind of regions.
Yeah, yeah. Africa, but as well the Middle East or Saudi Arabia to the north or Kuwait.
Yeah.
You know, So he supplies the region in general, but it's being shipped out again. Yeah. Therefore his refining premium is really that's an important moment. Yeah.
Martijn.
Yeah.
One of the reasons why we started the podcast was to provide more insights in what the job is all about. But also what makes the job of a commodity trader interesting? One of the things that I always enjoyed was you sit on a desk and something happens and then or a problem arises and then you need to resolve that. And you do that with intelligent people around you. And maybe first you have a conversation on the desk, and when the problems escalate, some said you involve seniors and you sit together. And very often I thought, hey, that's quite remarkable. We sit here with a small amount of people in a room facing a huge problem, but there's always a solution. And at those times you see leadership behavior, you see creativity, you learn from seniors, you can teach things to juniors. I've always, I look back at those periods as being very engaging. Now, if you look now, in the last couple of weeks, or basically since the beginning of the month, we have this whole tariff situation. Now, it's complex. Could you share...
What situation is that, Martijn?
The tariff situation It was in 2020, something similar where I think also the commodities industry were very much exposed with COVID, where supply chains got disrupted. Now, obviously in 22, when Russia invaded Ukraine as well, with a huge impact on grains, metals, energy. And now it's the tariffs. Can you share with the audience how you personally, but you and your teams in Viterra are actually dealing with that situation? So, You don't need to give an answer on how trade flows may move because it's so complex at the moment still, and we still have to figure out. But can you share with us what has happened since the last 1.5 week, and how your role is in actually making sense of this, and then indeed go through the process, analysis, game plan, execution, and how you experience that?
It's a very good question. And yes, it's very volatile and complicated, if you wish. And at times, you think, okay, what is going to be the final outcome of everything that's being discussed? Because it needs supposedly needs to be a negotiation, right, between between the US and all the other countries of the world. Now, I think the most lively example I have of this issue is not so much about sugar. The sugar itself, we trade around the US, but in the end, it's not extremely important to us when it comes to worldwide flows. Where it is extremely apparent, however, on a weekly basis, is that we have one meeting where we sit around with all the commodity leads and the freight desk. And this is, it started first with the additional port charges that the US wanted to raise against Chinese-built, Chinese-operated vessels, for instance. And so, yeah, we started to calculate like how much it would additionally cost to get products into the US, but also product out of the US. And then, so this is where we had a big debate, like, okay, so how is this going to play out? Then we entered into a second or two-tier market of vessels that were non-Chinese, operators that had no Chinese vessels in there, and operators that they did have. And you start to as well talk about management of their own books. How much Chinese vessels do we have, and what does it mean to us? So that was the first part of the discussion. Then later on, yeah, the new tariff system came in place, or at least was announced. And we started talking about Brazil, most of all, because Brazil is exporting a humongous amount of beans and of grains, but also of sugar. And most of it comes from the center-south of Brazil. And we had experienced in 2023, one of the reasons as well why the market actually spiked at that point, is that we didn't have enough elevation capacity. And we feel now that specifically, quote unquote, from the beans desk, is like, okay, it's a one shop origin at the moment, and it is Brazil. It's not the US. People are afraid of US origin, and they don't, you know, they have no idea at what kind of CNF levels it will
arrive.
And so, yeah, we started discussing, and this is where it's really becomes a bit dicey. Like, how much can you actually elevate out of Brazil? How much elevation capacity do you have in the ports? How much inland capacity do you have? And yeah, these are discussions. They go on and on. And you need to, on a month-by-month basis, try to figure out whether you actually have enough space for in our case, sugar, to be exported to the world.
Yep.
So this is, I think this is the most lively example how we, but for good orders, we export maybe 30 million tons out of Brazil. Of raw sugar, beans. Yeah, they need beans. Needs 130 million tons. So it starts to become a little bit of a fight over elevation capacity, trains availability, trucks availability. It's such a machine out there. And then if oranges start to swap from the US even more into Brazil, yeah, it really starts to become tricky, the whole situation.
So do you think then that the trading companies in general could maybe dive more into the supply chain of this industry?
You like long term, you mean?
Yeah.
Yeah.
If you have the assets, if you have ports, if you have elevation capacity, if you have the trains or whatever, then you know you basically create secure of supply.
Yeah, that's true. And if you own it already, yeah. I think it's great. If you now start to try and own it, I think you're late. And this is one of the stuff that we discussed as well. It's like, you know, about, and I overheard as well from heard the podcast with Chris about asset and how much of commodity traders started to buy their way into assets because it's a small space. There's no sustainable type of margins, etc. for trading it. But yeah, it's quite interesting that a lot, including ourselves, have invested throughout commodities into all kinds of assets. But if you go back in time, which the ones that were actually really successful are more the logistic ones and the ones with the optionality, and less so, for instance, in sugar, we had all the traders investing into sugar crushing. Yeah, and with one or two exceptions, it's been a small disaster, actually. They found out they were farmers and then you need to invest a humongous amount of money in order to keep it going. Then you roll in all kinds of issues. Then on top, the flat price was really dropping. So the guys, our competitors, really threw in the towel and with a humongous loss, actually. Yeah.
Because that game is then, what you say is like trading around an asset is different than having farmers.
Yeah, way different. Yeah, or being a farmer, even worse. Yeah. It's really, really different. Today, the environment is actually quite healthy. Our factories are running well. The flat price is high enough to to make money.
But does your team then, because does your team also have any knowledge of the actual farming part? Or do you have different teams and organizations with that run that farming, that run all that logistics, supply chain? I suppose you guys don't do everything there, but how do you have different teams doing that then that they are responsible for? Yeah, from farm part.
Yeah, certainly. Like, but we have a separate Brazilian agricultural part that really needs to optimize the yields of our own cane and needs to optimize the buying of third party cane that we need to run through our factories as well. So it's something, but it's not something we actively manage, not at all. But yeah, we just manage constantly like the commercial part of it, and
so exactly. So when does it come into your play? But from if it's on the farm, when do you say now I pick it up? Is it when it's in the port or when it's?
No. Earlier. I mean, we discuss on a weekly basis how the crush is going and when we start crushing, because we start relatively quickly now. One factory we started, the other one we need to wait. Yeah, but we discuss like what are the expected yields and absolutely. What will come out of our factories? What do we need to hedge? What can we expect of our program? Yeah, certainly.
But I think it can also give you a massive advantage, I would think, when you are embedded into the farms basically, because if you know what the yield is on your crop, you can have a good estimate on what is the yields from the other crops, right? I mean, if it's not too far away from you and they have the similar things and whatever, then it can give you an advance on knowledge, basically, right? I mean,
I think the problem with this is you're right. I mean, you have a more feel for what maybe more feel for what you can filter out is definitely wrong and definitely correct type of thing. So in this gray area, you can create a smaller gray area because the gray area is still big. There's certainly pockets of rain that people get and others don't get, and then you just don't know, or the variety in soil. Like how good is your soil versus your neighbor? Yep. And it can really vary from valley to valley type of thing. So it's complicated stuff. And we certainly try to do intelligent stuff on yield analysis from high above, from satellites. But it remains really, really complicated, this. Yeah. Kind of answers your answer, by the way, Martijn, but...
Yeah, absolutely. When I interview people, I always say, look, they're not dumb questions or dumb answers. Eh? So I'm going to apply that here too.
Here's what you say then.
This ethanol thing, why is that a Brazil thing and why not at all a European thing?
It is a European thing, but it was born way back, I think somewhere in the 80s or something. Mm-hmm. Where they started to produce more and more alcohol out of sugar, and it was a scheme back then to really have the cane industry survive. And so you just saw more and more that people would crush cane, and instead of adding crystallization capacity, which is then how to create sugar, they would just have a distillation plant, so they would have 100% alcohol to be produced from it. And it's just then when the cane area really expanded at a certain stage, they said, "Wow, we can actually commercially drive on this," and they really started to start creating a better logistic pipe system into gasoline stations, and today it's really quite efficient, but the mandate of adding biofuels to gasoline in this instance, we have the same in Europe. We do the same. I mean, everybody is.
But that is from vegetable oil mostly. Is it not?
No. If you in, I don't know by heart, but in gasoline, just there's certainly 10, 12, 15, 20%, whatever your engine can take, is alcohol today in Europe.
You got the feedstock, of course. Then it can be the alcohol, can be used cooking oil, it can be the veg oils.
Yeah, but oil is diesel. Yeah. So it really is, and we're really talking about alcohol, so being gasoline.
Yeah.
And most of the alcohol that we use in gasoline in Europe is imported, actually, or at least a great part of it, imported from Brazil, for instance.
And is it easy to switch around saying, hey, I'm going to valorize my cane into sugar or ethanol? Is it a switch within a day, or can they just say, hey, poof, we see ethanol today going this, poof, everything to the left, and all of a sudden it's that...
No, there's some planning indeed, and I think that if you have the average factory, then you have maybe, 10-15% of flexibility inside your system. So for instance, we're really sugar oriented in our factories, but we can switch. Today we produce maybe 15% only ethanol, and it could go up to 25% of the ethanol is better paid than sugar. Yeah, but for that you need to plan indeed, and you need yeast, right? Because you need a fermentation process, and they're after distillation. But starting to get really a little bit technical. But in general, but today, for instance, we think roughly 50% of the total Brazilian crop will go to ethanol, to ethanol, and therefore to sugar as well. Now, the world really needs sugar. So sugar is much better paid than ethanol today in Brazil. Mm-hmm. But you cannot exceed really this 50% anymore.
Why is that?
Yeah, because then there is no crystallization capacity anymore. So for crystallization, you need these pans and you need to create sugar crystals, basically.
And why can I not? And it's not interesting if the demand of sugar is good in the world. It's not possible to build extra capacity, because that sounds then commercially...
Yeah.
Viable.
Yeah, and this is really quite complicated. To build it, it's a complicated system. More importantly, the cane quality. You need good quality cane juice in order to produce sugar. Ethanol is way easier. You ferment and thereafter you. But if the cane is of a lesser quality, you just can't create good sugar out of it. Yeah. So today it's capped. Yeah. Yeah. It is. Yeah, despite price incentive to be bigger. Yeah.
Now you made a very interesting comment, and that is the world needs sugar. I saw a clip yesterday which showed how they made tomato ketchup, and they said, "Look, there's lots of sugar in it." And when I make my own pasta sauce, that's a secret recipe. There is no sugar in it. But if you buy a jar in the supermarket, there is definitely sugar in it. And you probably are aware of some biased media who say, look, sugar is bad for you, and you don't need sugar in all these things. And it's even in products that you think, why the hell is there sugar in it? It's to get the consumer hooked. Now, I also recall at times when I was trading cocoa that we said, look, there is a sentiment in Europe, less so in the US, but maybe it's shifting also a bit to the US, with a focus on more healthy living and consuming less sugar. How do you look at that? Is that not a trend, or how do you look at that situation?
Well, we look at our S&D worldwide. So our sugar is being exported to the likes of China, Indonesia, in order to be refined. So we look at a worldwide S&D and a worldwide consumption pattern. And we still see that population growth in Africa, for instance, and in the Middle East is just creating more consumption of for instance, sugar. But more interestingly, is there is certainly a health wave in the Western world, but not only the Western world. I mean, if you go to places like Malaysia, they consume too much as well, and they're really trying to have an anti sugar program in order for people to consume less. What is it for the Western world? You have to realize as well that the consumption is all indirect, so it's all industrialized. We barely have sugar at home. We barely use it. We sometimes throw it in a cup of coffee, but it starts to become less and less direct. So yeah, it's all indirect consumption. It's quite difficult to change this pattern, because it's initiated by consumers, but only if they start reading the ingredients of a package. And generally, we have to be honest, people don't. If I ask the average consumer of a Mars bar or something alike how much sugar is in there, they wouldn't be able to tell us, or they wouldn't be able to tell me. And so it requires kind of a consumption way of conscious consuming sugar to really drop from, for instance, what is normal in Europe is 35 kg per head per year, to drop actually to 30 or to 25.
And it's also seen as a cheap filler, eh?
Very often. Absolutely.
And so part of the rationing of demand in chocolate confectionery at the moment is by adding more sugar.
Yes. Yeah, and specifically if cocoa becomes very expensive, what it did recently, then you see people changing their recipes, in the advantage of sugar.
Yeah, but this is another reason why commodity trading is so interesting. Everything is interconnected, so I can assume, and the big scheme of things, cocoa, chocolate confectionery, maybe a small dent in the sugar industry of sugar S&D, but I can imagine that there may be an analyst in Viterra who has notified and said, guys, the cocoa market has reached historic highs. Demand has to be rationed. Part of that is reformulation. And the big chocolate confectionery companies, they will become creative.
Yes. Yeah.
Correct. And they will put applications on the shelf containing more sugar and less cocoa content. Because at the end of the day, they don't want to lose market share. They want to sell the same volume.
Yes.
That's the whole point. And sugar is a solution to that. So is that true indeed that maybe although small, but that is a nice example of how commodities are interconnected.
Yes.
I've got
another example for you, because worldwide, most of the coffee is consumed with a lot of sweeteners.
Okay.
Iced coffee is a big trend in the Western world, or iced coffee at least. I mean, while coffee is getting more expensive, consumption of coffee is going down, and therefore the consumption of sugar is going down as well.
Mm.
Just as an additive. What the most interesting trend that we see today in the Western world, and actually you see it happening as well in places like Malaysia or even places like China, is actually the medicine Ozempic. Because now, you know, the reasons, you know, so for instance, America, they are for 40%+ obese.
Yeah.
The overweight percentage in America is, I hope you sit tight, but it's 82%. So these are guys with BMI, I don't know, above 25. Ozempic is now used by 17 million adults in the US.
70?
No, 17.
17 million.
Yeah. Out of 250 adults in America. Yeah. But the guys that use this, these are generally like large consuming, to put it popularly, is like, okay, they flush away with Coke, they flush away a bucket of ice cream, or so it really is. So this in America will certainly create a big dent in consumption of sweeteners, we believe.
Yeah.
Yeah. And mind you, we consume about 35 kg in Europe per head per capita. In the US, it's easily double. So.
But why does Ozempic? Because Ozempic, I mean, that's always the great story that it increased the GDP of Denmark with 10% and these kind of things. It's amazing.
It does as well.
What it did. But why do you think then? Because they use Ozempic to lose weight, etc., to be more healthier. So it's more a lifestyle change, whereas Ozempic is part of it, mm-hmm. where you see the demand of sugar decreasing in US.
Yeah.
Because and Ozempic is part of solving their health problems.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And like, okay, so it's a really technical story, but at least all in all, your feel of hunger
goes away, demand. Yeah.
And you easily consume 50% less food, if not less.
Yeah.
Yeah. Unhealthy food in this instance.
Yeah. And then better they can use it for proteins or
whatever. Well, yes. But at the same time, you have to assume as well that protein consumption will go down. So you know, when it's about meat or,
I have another question with the youngsters in mind who are looking for a job or maybe change jobs. What I think nowadays is much more focused on than we started. There was also very little access to information about that is a company culture. And you have worked in reputable companies that we all know well, Cargill, Sugden, Glencore, now Viterra, and Viterra then moving into Bunge, right? Could you briefly share some of the cultural things that you recall from having worked in those different companies and what at the end of the day suits your culture, or for your character, what culture suits your character?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, they were certainly very different firms, all of them. And I think to start with one end of the spectrum, like a French trade house like Sukden, family owned, it's a strong hierarchy in the company. It means to say like anything large, any large decisions will always involve someone or the total family to the decision. It's as well quite it's a very nice and good environment. At the same time, you really have a lot of cultural differences with, for instance, the Dutch. So, for instance, they don't like people laughing at them. They don't like it. So, for instance, when you introduce yourself and you start laughing, they either think you're making fun of them, or you're hitting on them, or they think you're just dumb. So this is, and when I arrived in 2010, 11, we still had a guy in a as you call it, a penguin suit, serving coffee. So he would serve coffee to the board, and he would serve coffee to the Ross trading desk, and that's it. He would come with a plan.
Wow, that's next level.
Yeah,
that's really next level.
Yeah, yeah. So and that was it was a super nice. But yeah, this is the environment where I started.
But then, if you wanted to take a position, always somebody from the management family would be involved.
Well, I mean the desks are roughly the same. So it's generally we had centralized positions. So we would discuss what we want to do, and you kind of execute on a game plan. But yeah, you could see in the French culture as well, you would come into a meeting and you would discuss the S&Ds and come out with an outcome. Yeah, that generally doesn't work in Paris. It was the conclusions were already set. Let's put it that way. So you can talk, and they don't mind talking. So you just keep talking. But in the end, yeah, you just come to the same conclusion. So it certainly is. Yeah, it's a bit indirect, and they yeah that's the way. But at the same time, yeah, good quality house, and yeah, really very successful. Whatever you want to say about them.
On the other great parties in London they give.
Yes, there you go. And on the other end of the spectrum was certainly Glencore. Like super direct, Dutch British. I mean, really cut to the chase, and a very small amount of time wasted. Very efficient, but at time, yeah, a bit maybe too direct and culturally insensitive. Could you name it as well? But yeah, but at the same time, very entrepreneurial guys that take the additional step to come up with pretty dynamic game plans. And as well, yeah, take the additional leap of risk, and get on with it, type of thing. So that's, I think, that was Glencore, and that today is Viterra, still the same type of characters, and still the same type of culture. In the middle, I guess you have Cargill. Certainly, because you have just different nationalities in the firm. But it's a firm that really requires to do your homework, and people are extremely professional and driven, and take an additional step as well to teach, like the younger take the additional the human resource, or to teach the younger in order to grow in into the firm.
Yeah.
I think when it comes to myself, Martijn, I was really happy to start with Cargill.
Yeah.
It was the easiest school to learn, and I think the smoothest path into commodity trading. And Sukden is just more you create your own shop, and then you even add at times your own P&Ls. So while you're all on the same desk. And Viterra is just in the middle, and at the moment suits my personality best.
Did you once consider going into a different commodity? Did you, or was it for you never? Because we see often that people stay within one line of commodity, right? And sometimes they had some here and there some conversations. Have you ever had a commodity you was like, oh, that must be a really cool commodity, or amazing, or sugar? You think there's nothing beats sugar?
No. Have to be. I think it's not even really commodity driven, but really network driven and culturally driven. So that you, at a certain stage, you just feel that it fits and that it works well and that the opportunities are good. I like personally very much from sugar that it's so interconnected with the energy complex,
yeah.
And so yeah, it's always just been it's always been like a nicely diversified commodity that what I said earlier, that very much in the beginning, that at the same time is a soft commodity, but tends to trade specifically on the raw sugar side, more like grains.
Yep.
So yeah. Yeah.
And if you look at now, I mean, also now you're running a team, you're running the book, and you have young people around you there as well. Managing the traders, managing logistics, managing the team, managing expectations within the company, the other heads, etc. Yeah. Did you have the time to grow into that role, or was it really like a shock and you had to do a lot of trainings and then can you actually, when you are starting as a trader, as a junior trader, etc., is it actually, because I think that not everybody's is meant to be a manager, right? And etc. And I think sometimes are better off being just the best trader ever. How was this for you?
Yeah. I mean, yes, it was maybe a little bit of a shock, like a shock event from a trader to more like a manager role. But at the same time, so yeah, maybe you're not like constantly calling, deal making, trading futures anymore. But at the same time, so you kind of maybe take a step back and look at the desk and the game plans more holistically, and then you start to realize that you're trading just more, maybe a bit more longer term, and more the assets, and maybe even to the people. You know, it doesn't sound nice, but you want to have like the best personalities, your best suited personalities for certain areas and certain trades.
Yep.
And you start to think then only about the products itself or trading opportunities. You take a little bit of a step back and you start to commercially kind of figure out which people suit best to what areas and how you can be the most successful trading desk. Yeah. So, it's different, but it certainly is still like a commercial job, and instead of just purely trading the commodities, you trade a little bit the people, and that doesn't sound nice, of course, but the assets a bit more. Yeah. So it's more of that, but yeah, no, it's what maybe less enjoyable are reviews and of course paperwork, managing up in the firm. Yeah. Okay. But yeah, this comes with the job type of thing.
Do you then miss it a bit? The old days of really being
certainly
the deal maker.
I need to help myself because sometimes they cut a corner, like brokers or customers or suppliers, and they give a direct phone call. And yeah, of course you need to hold yourself not to just get into the deal and book it type of thing. So yeah.
There's something related to that and something that Alex said in the introduction. He said that everyone likes you. Huh? Now, I also recall that from your time in Cargill. You're a guy that you can get along with very easily, always optimistic, a fun guy. You like to hang out, right?
That's true, yes.
We've drank some beers here and there.
Yes, we did, yes.
But this is also a cutthroat business. And at the end of the day, to survive with external thieves and some internal ambitious people, they also need to know, don't fuck with me. Mm. Yeah? Now, you as a as a nice guy, you would have said it differently than I did. I said it like this.
Yes.
But how did you say it?
Where's his dark side?
No, okay. It's maybe it sounds a bit corny, but no, I don't think it's always necessary or barely necessary. For myself, it's really about staying straight, staying honest, open, transparent to people that they understand what they have with you or that they can count on you. Type of thing. I thought that was specifically in a normal office environment, because I see how for instance the media would broadcast how trading works and how traders work, but 99 out of 100 occasions we're just doing our job, right? We're just sitting at a desk and figuring out, solving problems and creating game plans, and so it's very much like any other firm. and we can make it as exciting as we want to. And of course, there's moments where, a lot of money is lost or gained. And you need to realize as well that a lot flows through your hands. But I think bottom line, people just really need to be able to count on you. And that you are a straight shooter, and that you and that you don't change up, and that comes as well to like new enterers into the market. It's a long breath. You need to be patient indeed, like how we and people need to start trust you and realizing that they can count on you, and So I, of course, there's been some elbow work, and when there's a moment of dividing the world, or who's going to call this? Of course, there's a moment that you need to raise your first hand and say, "Okay, I'll do it." And I've never used the words that you used. In the meantime, you shouldn't fuck with me, but
let that be very clear. Here. No, because also the kids, of course, need to know that, right? Otherwise, your weekends are gone.
Now the thing is, I recall a situation in my traineeship that I bought a cargo of sunflower oil. And my counterparty wanted to default on me. And then this guy called me and he said, "I want to talk to your boss." And I said, "I'm the boss." But those are interesting things.
Absolutely.
Hey, that is a quality, because look, what I also want to stress to the younger audience is the career as a commodity trader isn't only the analytical stuff, and that's what you think it is in the beginning of your career, that you can make commercial decisions. But along the way, as you grow, it's you're almost doing 4D chess, and you need to read the room. You need to understand what the interests of everyone is inside the company, but also when you attend events or complex meetings with policymakers, with others. At the end of the day, you need to be, you need to be smart and thinking about how am I going to be effective. And so think about the goals that you have, treat people with respect and all those kind of things. And along the way, you learn that. And so that is as important to become successful.
Agree.
In the industry.
Yes.
As being a smart trader.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah. Totally agree. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Then we're coming here to the end of this podcast. I have one more question before we end. Sein, for the younger generation, if they would like to have a career in trading just like yourself, or want to apply at Bunge, Viterra, and beautiful companies you've been working for, what would your advice be? Them
it is as applying to any other job, but you're thinking more in a way what type of personality or when should you apply type.
Well,
of,
more like what would you think is like the what would you like to do if you would like to be a junior trader in your team at Sugar? What are the things you need like to travel, you need to be in a relationship, you need to maybe stress deal with that. What are the things that you think somebody skill set should be when they want to apply, right? It's not for everybody.
Certainly. I think the part of it is generally a global game. So your mindset needs to be global. And the cultural sensitivity is, I think, important, yes. And we do send people out to go somewhere and sit in meetings and try to make something of it. And we expect something to come back as well. So that certainly needs to be a part of your personality, and is going to be a part of the job. At the same time, we are starting to get more technical, or the information technology for us is becoming more and more important. So your mindset, it's better that your mindset is on this front as well, whether it's AI or whether it's just general technology. It's starting to become really important as well for us. So it's not a simple answer, but we see as well that we are a physical commodity trader, and part of our competition comes from funds, from CTAs. And but we still have the fundamental flows, and we think that the fundamental analysis is kind of the best with us, right?
Yeah.
But CTAs, guys like Citadel, for instance, would say like, okay, it's with us. We are the ones that are able to, without being any part of the physical flows or any part of the, have the best analysis. And what we see happening is that actually, because they have no ambition to come into the physical space. We have an ambition to get into their space. So that's something.
Is that an increasing part, the hedge funds?
Yeah, of course. Yes. It's really important. And then to as well that we are able to estimate their order flow in the market when because generally they're momentum traders, right? So it's not like it's okay. Some of them make it really super complicated, but generally it's something that is predictable and how we and so yeah, we are changing as well partly the model of being able to compete with these guys as well. So that potentially, if you're a starter, that's something we very much look at as well. Yeah. Yeah.
That's a super interesting comment you made.
Yeah.
Because I believe it's 100% true. They have no ambition to go through all the hassle of physical trading.
Yes.
While you guys have an ambition and indeed should strive to better understand the CTA drivers. That's great
and so we try and then not just because they are successful, right? And there were moments that we thought that we were big players in this market and then we just appeared to be small.
Imagine the risk they take and the appetite they have for sometimes, and then sometimes in the market then they're out again.
Correct. Yeah.
Okay.
I hope that answers the question.
Yes, Martin, yeah. Beautiful. Thank you very much for being in this episode.
Great pleasure. Thank you.
Talking about World Sugar, I think I also learned something about ratoons. If I say correctly, not a raccoon, but a ratoon.
No, it's not a raccoon. It's a ratoon.
A ratoon.
Yeah.
So 7 times for Brazil, the gain in Brazil.
Good. Right. And very in China it is?
2 times.
Three.
Three. And the world's 2 times then?
India.
India. Oh, see. Okay, good. I will not forget. Thank you very much, and we very much enjoyed.
Thank you. Thank you, guys.
It was great, Martin.
Welcome, and thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.